Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the North Dakota Medical Association's Wednesday weekly webinar, an open forum discussion. I'm Courtney Coble, Executive Director of NDMA. On behalf of the North Dakota Medical Association, I thank all of you for attending this webinar and for your membership commitment to North Dakota Medical Association. Just a reminder, this webinar is being recorded. In COVID news, HHS expects to distribute approximately $15 billion to eligible physicians and organizations that participate in state Medicaid and CHIP programs and have not received a payment from the Provider Relief Fund general allocation yet. Starting June 10th, HHS plans to launch a portal that will allow eligible physicians and organizations to report their annual patient revenue data and other necessary information to receive a payment equal to at least 2% of reported gross revenues from patient care. We will have some information in our e-physician about this tomorrow morning, but please contact me if you need further information. NDMA met this week with Action PPE. It's a group purchasing organization started by a medical society in South Carolina. And our members and their facilities will have the opportunity on our website to purchase PPE with this group. Action PPE works with manufacturers from the U.S. and outside the U.S., and impressed us with their dedication to quality. Their prices are competitive. Many state medical associations are using it with success, including South Dakota and Wisconsin. Stay tuned on more information on how to place an order. We are getting a button put on our website, and if you need to have it before then, please let me know and contact me. That's all I have for now. I'd like to introduce our panelists for tonight. I see Joan Connell is on, our North Dakota Department of Health Medical Field Officer, and she also leads a physician advisory group, and she'll share the latest COVID-19 update. I don't know if anyone caught this, but she was the star of the press conference today. She talked about well child visits and visits and immunization and answered questions with her usual grace and intelligence. So good job today, Joan. I'd also like to welcome Tim Wiedrick to our webinar. Tim is currently the Emergency Preparedness and Response Section Chief for the North Dakota Department of Health. Tim received a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration and has a Master of Science in Business Management from the University of Mary. He also received a Certificate of Public Health Emergency Preparedness from the University of Minnesota. Welcome, Tim. We're very happy to have you. After the presentations, we'll have the opportunity for open discussion. Please type your question in the question box, and if necessary, you will be unmuted to present your question or discussion topic. So thanks again for both the panelists, and I will hand it over to Dr. Connell.
Thank you so much. I'm going to take you with me because my husband's on call tonight and my dog is trapped in the in our mudroom. So she will bark if I don't fix this. Okay, so it's been another exciting week at the North Dakota Department of Health. We started after our last meeting together. We met as a physician advisory group and talked again with Dr. Stahl about changing the current remdesivir criteria to make it more accessible, basically by changing the oxygen saturation requirement from less than 88% to less than or equal to 94%, as well as changing one of the comorbidities of age, which we had originally suggested as greater than 75 years old to greater or equal to 50 years old. Dr. Stahl's response was, that sounds great. We need to have this drug available for people who need it. So we'll be revisiting the criteria in a couple of weeks to make sure that we're on track with these recommendations. We also talked about how exactly influenza and COVID testing would work this fall through the Department of Health and the state lab. And so we'll be providing more information for you regarding that. We did also talk about a behavioral health modeling project that came out of Washington State, which is very interesting and talks about when you can expect increased risks of suicide, depression, anxiety, given the timing of the pandemic, and this, you know, every state is obviously different. So just today I spoke with Chris Jones from the Department of Human Services about this project, hoping that it might be pursued in North Dakota. So we're talking about it and we'll see what happens. Other things we talked about that I'm going to let Tim cover more fully are the where we are with PPE. And one of the things that we're looking for forward to from Tim is a comparison of UV versus hydrogen peroxide methods of decontamination to see, you know, to help you decide what would be best for your facility. Since the physician advisory group meeting, we have also worked on immunization and access issues. So today at the press conference, we talked about the need for getting more screenings done, preventive health screenings, catching up on immunizations, really taking this opportunity to take care of our preventive health. So because obviously cancer and needs for immunization, that sort of thing, didn't go away once COVID-19 hit North Dakota. So now all cases are down. We're really encouraging people to take advantage of that. Sorry, that's my dog again. and then Courtney and I have sat through hours, literally, of Medicaid meetings this week. And I'm not sure if she covered those in her briefing to you. But one of the things that came up, I had pursued the concern about reimbursement from Medicaid with the Medicaid department. And I discovered that CMS nationally does not consider preventive visits to be reimbursable via telehealth. So that was a big eye-opener for me, and we're having some conversations about it, but given that it's a federal, this is coming from the federal level, I don't know how much success we'll have at changing this. So I think the challenge is between now and fall, when we are expected to see a surge, how we're going to make a plan for doing all of the screenings, all of the important things that we need to do as part of preventive care with the least risk possible to our patients and to ourselves as healthcare workers. So I would love to be able to share ideas about that. And then the other major thing we discussed during these meetings is some of the other Medicaid issues, like continuous glucose monitors and the fact that they don't cover continuous glucose monitors for kids. And basically, we are on step one of probably a five-step plan of making changes to arbitrary rules like that. But we're on the road. So that makes me really hopeful. And so if you guys have other things that you're understanding that Medicaid is not covering, please reach out to us and we will add them to the list and advocate for you. And we will also help you learn how to advocate, how to self-advocate for some of these things. And maybe we can work together. I think that about covers it. Thank you, everyone, and sorry for the disruption of my basset hound.
Thanks a lot, Joan. I think we need to, I did not mention our Medicaid meetings. I guess I was focusing more on COVID, but as far as the Medicaid reimbursement of telehealth, oh, cute. He's very cute. I don't know if I believe them that it's a CMS rule. I think we need to investigate that a little bit more, because all we've been hearing is how CMS is covering telehealth, and for it not to apply to that, I think is kind of ridiculous. So there's more to come on that. We're going to be talking about telehealth parity, I think, for the next year for sure.
Well, and so I'll just tell you, though, I looked on CMS's the reimbursable codes, and 9939Xs are not on there.
Really? And,
yeah. So the thought that I can call a patient or have a patient call me on the phone and tell me they have right ear pain, and I can say, oh, you have otitis media, let me prescribe you an antibiotic, and that's covered, yet spending my average 29 to 43 minutes doing all of the screenings over the phone, all of the anticipatory guidance, as much physical exam as I can possibly do virtually, is not covered, is absolutely sickening to me, particularly at this time where we really have to be doing these mental health screenings. And other, you know, when I'm doing exams, I'm looking at all the skin parts, looking for non-accidental trauma. So there's something very wrong with this, and we need to change it.
Yeah, definitely. We had a hand raise at the beginning, and I'm going to allow you to talk, Dr. Govan. If you want to raise your question, you may have to unmute yourself on your computer. And you could, maybe she typed it in the question box. No, she did not. Okay, I'll leave you unmuted, and Gigi, if you can figure that out, you let us know. All right, Joan, there's three
questions.
Actually,
I'll tell you, there was an accident. I did not have a question, sorry.
Okay. So I am seeing some. Do you anticipate that there will be a modifier code to cover additional costs associated with COVID-19, like PPE, extra viral filters, screening patients, et cetera? You know, I have not heard about any of that, but I think that's something we can certainly look for and advocate for. I think the fact that we're not being charged for the test, people think that that's a big give. But I agree with you. These other things, and that's one of the things that sort of burned me, is you have to remember that for the patient convenience, when they say, oh no, I'll just come in and be seen live, that increases my exposure risk as well as my patients. So having some help with the extra cost of PPE for patient and provider, I think is definitely a necessity. And then COVID testing not being covered by some insurance policies, how can we ask our patients to get tested prior to procedures if this isn't being covered? And I would say to that, what we were able to do through our surgical leads meeting, by making it allowable for pre-op testing to be done through the North Dakota Department of Health, is very useful to answer this particular concern. And that is how I would be recommending all facilities get their pre-op testing done, because I think not only will it save everybody money, patients, and likely the healthcare facilities, but it will also serve as some level of surveillance testing around the state. And Governor Burgum was just talking about recommendations coming from Dr. Birx, I think, regarding doing more surveillance testing in our state. So this is a great way where we can hit two birds with one stone.
And so then, Joan, would your suggestion then to Dr. Khosla here would be for her to submit the test to the North Dakota Department of Health?
Right. Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely. Thanks. Sorry if I didn't make that clear. And then is there a restriction on who can administer a COVID test? Scope of practice limitations? Do you have to be a lab tech or nurse to obtain a nasopharyngeal swab? You know, I think that's a good question. And I think I'm going to get back to you, Dr. Khosla, and I will do a little bit of research here. So maybe when Tim's finished, I will have an answer, because I think the answer is yes currently, but I want to make sure of that. And then I will also say that I've seen in the literature they are working on, or there is some access to home testing. So, and I haven't read too much about that, but I think that is going to be something that is on the horizon.
All right. I'm just going to check, see if there's any more hand raised. And there is not. So thank you, Dr. Connell. And I will hand it off to Tim Wiedrich. Thank you, Tim.
All right. Thank you so much for the opportunity to visit with you. I picked out a few things, four of them to be exact. I wanted to kind of highlight about the COVID response during our discussion today. And so I'm going to go ahead and bring some slides up here. And let me close this. All right, so the data that I have is as of 2 days ago. I prepared these slides yesterday, and I pulled the previous day's data. And I just want to touch on a couple of points regarding the response activity. First, I want to talk about, in terms of one of the major strategic responses, is to do a reduction in the transmission. And so obviously the public health tools that are at typical disposal are things like social distancing, isolation, quarantine, and contact tracing. There have been some pretty remarkable numbers that have been generated. So far during this COVID response, we've had 12,151 cases that we've performed contact tracing on, with roughly about 150 folks that are doing that contact tracing. In terms of the testing numbers, one of the strategies that we have employed is there are a variety of tests that are available, obviously using a variety of platforms. And we have some pretty impressive numbers in terms of the testing that's been completed so far. A little over 80,000 tested so far. Of those, 77,300 have been negative. We've had 2,880 that are positive. And we have had 72 deaths as of 2 days ago within the state. As part of that testing strategy, we've employed a number of ways that's been carried out in terms of the specimen collection and the laboratory analysis. We've substantially increased the number of people that are available to do specimen collection. At the state level, there are teams a little over, 120 folks that are available right now for doing specimen collection and the various iterations that's being done. And for laboratory analysis, prior to COVID, our laboratory was processing a little less than 200 specimens a day, and our current capacity is over 4,000 a day. And we do expect that to peak off at 6,000 a day in terms of that level of capacity. I do want to touch quickly on the state medical cash. You may not be familiar with this, but it's a cash that we started about 16 years ago. We've been building it for the past 16 years. And in it are the supplies that we have stockpiled for situations where the private medical sector doesn't have adequate PPE, for example, but a wide variety of other types of things are in this stockpile. It's valued at a little over $15 million currently. But it's the primary source that we've been utilizing for PPE. And I do want to talk about that just briefly. Coming into this COVID response, I'll use a couple of kind of surrogates to describe in general the quantities that were available. So for N95 respirators, we began with 1.6 million that were part of what was in the state medical cache. And for surgical masks, we had about 2.4 million in the stockpile. And obviously a wide variety of other PPE is in addition to that. But our current levels, we are at about 600,000 from the 1.6 million N95 respirators. So we've distributed about a million of these. And we have not successfully been able to identify large replenishment resources yet. We have an order in for about a million, and this is looking like it's going to be a promising order, but the projected delivery date is going to be towards the end of July. And hopefully that order does in fact come to fruition and we receive it. Obviously, if there is a second wave, if Ebola is any type of an instruction for us, it took about 6 to 8 months before we were able to adequately restore the private distribution systems for being able to replenish PPE in that situation. And obviously this is a much more extensive global consumption of PPE than what Ebola resulted in. So I do have concerns about maintaining the levels of PPE that we have restocked as soon as possible. And so those are strategically the approaches that we're taking. We're attempting very aggressively to order from reliable sources and get product in that gets us back into a pre-COVID situation before the fall of the year. But an important part of that is going to also be conservation of the materials and the PPE that we currently have. That's PPE. In addition to that, we have some substantial quantities of other types of medical, both durable and disposable supplies and equipment that are part of the medical cache. The distribution of the contents of this, in normal times, the idea is that this is a backup to the private distribution system, that we always rely on the private distribution system as the first level, and we only do this when it's not available. So in less severe times, there's an expectation that the individuals that are consuming it and are charging for the product replenish it back into the state medical cache. That may not be the situation as we're moving forward. There may be federal assets that are available for us to replenish this. And so for those that have obtained the supplies, it was coming with little notices that are saying, we would like to have this, you replace this when it becomes available on the private distribution system once again, but we'll get more information to you about that, whether that actually is necessary or not. And that's you're seeing images of the inside of the state medical cache and what that actually looks like. The other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is the surge capacity for medical surge. And so specifically with the hospital surge plan, there are three tiers that are part of the hospital surge plan. Normal operations, we have 2,098 beds, and so that's the stage that we're in at this point. If in fact we began to see a substantial internal surge, we have a tier 2A for that, and that's 2,394 beds. That's the amount that hospitals are indicating that they can surge to, relying on their own internal resources. In other words, additional staff that they have available and additional supplies and equipment. Tier 2B are state-supported surge numbers, and that's relying on staffing coming from the state and also medical supplies and equipment coming from the state medical cache. And with that assistance, it's estimated that there are 3,400 beds that would be available. Once we've gone beyond 2B, the planning process that we've been doing for the last, frankly, 16 years, the hospitals have always indicated that our main limitations for hospitalization would be personnel, and then we would start to move into equipment and supply shortages after that. Physical space has never been our limitation in terms of the hospital association, or the hospitals themselves assessment of what limiting factors are. So for that reason, our tier three are something in the COVID response process that we call a minimum care facility, that we would surge the hospitals at 2B to include the actual hospital care at that level. And then as part of the general plan, if in fact we have completed that level and we were continuing to surge, that we would be establishing gymnasium style care venues that would not be necessarily providing hospital level care. This would be truly minimum care consisting of hydration, nutrition, and hygiene. Some level of ventilatory support could also be provided at these facilities, and that they would be carried, that care provision would be done primarily by volunteers and family members at that level. Again, with the thought that at 2B we would have consumed the majority, if not all, of the available medical staff. So that was just a very high level description of what the hospital surge plan looks like within our state. In terms of the hospitalization, we have had a total of 184 that have been hospitalized during this event. 29 are currently hospitalized. Then the final thing I wanted to touch on is the Battelle decontamination process. And you're seeing images of this. It's a hydrogen peroxide process. It's set up in Bismarck. It has the capacity of doing 80,000 N95 respirator decontaminations, and that's a day. So it has a huge volume that's associated in terms of the capacity. There's a little over 125 organizations that have registered, so hospitals, clinics, any medical system or public safety system that's using PPE can sign up for this process. And it consists basically of an identification registration that starts at this website that I have on battelle.org/decon. And then from there are materials that are provided to send through normal carrier systems like FedEx, the N95 respirators into the decontamination center. The respirators are marked, and the same respirators that are sent in are returned back to the organization that sent them in for decontamination. The exceptions would be that they are screened for if they're soiled or damaged, and those are discarded when they arrive at our facility. So if there's makeup or body fluids on any of the PPE, that is in fact discarded and not sent through the decontamination process. Once the respirators are inspected, they're placed into these racking systems, and the hydrogen peroxide is applied for the appropriate treatment time, and then measurements are taken for the parts per million to assure that the decontamination is effective in various spots within the chamber, and then a ventilation process happens. And measurements taken once again to make sure that the product has been appropriately ventilated following this decontamination process, and the N95 respirators are repackaged and then distributed back to the facilities. I know that there was some circulation of some news articles that caused concern about the decontamination process, and it centered on some quotations that were part of a news article that talked to several nurses that did not feel comfortable with the process or raised issues about claims of being able to process N95 respirators up to 20 times. But I can tell you the National Institutes of Health is the study that we're relying on that says that it's safe to and effective to process up to 3 times. And the masks are in fact marked so that they're tracked right on the mask, the number of decons that have been conducted, and after the third decontamination process, then the masks are no longer utilized or eligible for decontamination. If there are further studies done by an independent entity like National Institutes of Health, we would reconsider that policy, but that's where we're at today. Dr. Connell mentioned another process that we're working on, and that's the ultraviolet light. And unfortunately, I don't have these fancy images to share with you for that, but that's because there are two 53-foot trailers that are being constructed. One is almost done. I received a report today that the first one has the interior completely finished. And so I expect that that will be received by us in probably about a week that we should be able to take possession of that. A second one will be built. And then the idea is that these 53-foot trailers that really consist of three chambers. The first chamber is where the product is, the dirty room that basically the product will be unpacked, affixed to racks, moved into the ultraviolet light chamber, and exposed to the ultraviolet light, and then passed through the rest of the trailer to the other side, which is the clean side, where they're repackaged for distribution back to the entities that provided the N95 respirators. The content of those will be 400 respirators per hour. So that will be the throughput of those trailers. And while we don't have a specific route established, that is the idea that we'll be taking those trailers on the road so that the facilities that don't have their own internal capability for doing ultraviolet light decontamination, that we'll be able to supplement with this portable system that would be moving throughout the state to provide decontamination. I don't have the specific data for that in terms of, the processes, but I can tell you that the ultraviolet's been used for some time for a wide variety of decontaminations, and it is an authorized use under the emergency authorization processes that Food and Drug Administration has in place. And that there has been no reported deterioration that is of any real consequence in terms of using ultraviolet light. But as we begin to introduce that capability, we'll have a lot more information about that. I would just encourage you once again to go back to the battelle.org /decon, register. This is a free service, and to please preserve the N95 respirators that we currently have, so that if in fact we aren't able to replenish our supplies, that we have preserved what we do currently have. That's the information that I intended to bring to you today, and I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you may have.
Thanks a lot, Tim. That was very interesting. I am going to open it up for questions. If you want to raise your hand or type it in the question box. And I do have a few questions myself if we have some shy listeners.
Do you mind if I make a comment, Courtney?
Of course, of course.
First of all, I have texted 3 different people, and I'm waiting for an answer to the question about who has to collect the specimen. And I don't see any requirements in anything I've read. So I can't give you a firm answer, but also that isn't a limitation. And then I did find beginning the middle of April was the first emergency use authorization by the FDA given to a home collection test that is then sent in for analysis, and it appears that those are either nasal swabs or oral swabs. So that's what I know so far. My second comment about what Tim said is I was not aware of that caveat of needing to replace the PPE that has been provided to you. So actually that potentially answers one of the questions as well. If your facility is utilizing medical cash PPE, hopefully Tim will work out a deal so you don't have to replace it by obtaining some grant funding that will replace it. So we're a big fan of you, Tim, as you try and work out that option for us so our costs aren't further increased. Thanks.
Yeah, and I'm really confident that that's not going to be the case. That process was really designed for onesies and twosies where we didn't have a large disaster or emergency declaration at a national level. So I really wouldn't give that a second thought. I really think that that's resolved.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah, I did want to say, too, that Tim has worked around the clock. I mean, he's the hardest working man in show business. He's on all different meetings and calls, and so we really appreciate you. Tim, one of the questions I had was, who were those people doing the Battelle cleaning, you know, the ones taking them out of the boxes? Who are those people?
Yeah, Battelle actually has a federal contract. So FEMA and Health and Human Services procured not just the equipment, but also a contract to provide the staffing. And so those are actually a subcontractor that Battelle has provided. They are from out of state. They're physically staying in North Dakota while this is underway. And so it truly is a federally funded operation.
Oh, I see. Very interesting. Now, I received this question during my workday today about whether or not, and maybe Joan, or you can also maybe answer this too, have you, either of you, heard anything about when the North Dakota's peacetime emergency will expire?
Well, I have not. And so okay. I've not had any inkling about the expiration of the emergency declaration.
Rumor on the street was that it was going to be expiring at the end of this month, but.
Well, I think we would need to be in the blue zone or, you know, before that would have to be achieved. So,
So it's a little bit of a, I'm going to go in a little bit more detail. You know, I think that's a little bit of a tricky question in that there's several declarations. There's the National Public Health Declaration. There's the state declarations. There's the executive orders in place. And I have no doubt that those executive orders are going to keep coming and going. As time moves forward and our circumstances change. But in terms of actually removing the emergency declaration at the federal level or the major portions of this operation, we're not done yet. We've got a lot of activity that still has to happen. So I'm not seeing any type of a wholesale withdrawal of the emergency status by the end of this month. I don't believe that will happen.
All right, thank you. I'll pass that along. It was kind of the rumor on the street, I think. What to you, Tim, what has been the most difficult obstacle in doing your work during this emergency?
I think that almost every emergency has kind of a communication fog associated with it. And because I hope this doesn't come off in a negative way, but we're used to dealing with floods and tornadoes and all kinds of large-scale emergencies that we really have a pretty predictable pattern associated with it. Fortunately, we don't do a lot of global pandemics. And while there was preparation in place, when I look at how this disease unfolded, you know, obviously airborne would have been so much more difficult to deal with. But the fact that we have asymptomatic transmission of this really created some, and is creating, continue to some huge challenges associated with it. And so, So I think just the novelty of it and the fact that we have asymptomatic transmission has set up some real obstacles.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And you know, with these mixed messages, it seemed like the same day we received from two very reputable authorities, one that there's no asymptomatic transmission and one that it's 44%. It's hard to believe, but learning every day.
And, you know, part of that are what I call communication fog issues. So World Health Organization has begun to walk back some of what was originally indicated. And so I think that's part of it. But the other is, you know, the science has got to try and get caught up. That's not easy. And there was very little known about this specific strain. And so huge challenges.
Well, and I would just like to add to that, I come back to the articles that I'm clinging to for support on COVID are the same level of research of medical marijuana articles that I continue to scoff at. So to do high quality research takes volumes of patients and volumes of time. So we are going to, there are going to be things that we learn that contradict what we're currently recommending. I think that's inevitable, and that is why. It's because we have to follow the science. And we've been trying to do that very conservatively to save lives. And hopefully we can loosen that up a bit as we learn more from better quality research.
I agree. I mean, it just seems like every webinar we learn something new, and we're going to look back on this, on the COVID epidemic, and we're going to be, these webinars and all these discussions are going to be for the history books. I'm glad that they're being recorded. Tim, during your presentation, you talked, it was very impressive, that warehouse. Can you tell us where that warehouse is?
I can tell you that it's generally in Bismarck.
Okay.
Beyond that, we tend not to kind of disclose its location.
Right. I understand. How do you feel about our PPE supply if we do get another surge in October? How do you feel about it?
So I think that we're still in a very strong position, especially when I look compared to many other states. With N95 respirators, with the 600,000 that we currently have in the state medical cache, there's roughly about another 400,000 that's within the medical system. So we're still at about 1 million N95 respirators that are available to us. We can't squander it, but we have not had the difficulties that many other states have had trying to supply medical PPE to the medical system because we had the blessing of this medical cache.
Oh, that's terrific news. Just terrific news. Dr. Koslog had another follow-up question that I had sent to you, but we might as well answer on here. Is there any advice on the most appropriate test to do prior to procedures?
So Dr. Connell, I'm gonna turn to you with that.
Okay, thank you. So I think that in an ideal world, we would have SOFIA antigen testing that available on site for day of pre-op and used in areas of low prevalence. It is the ideal test, I think. And we could use that at 5:30 in the morning to screen all our pre-op patients. Those who are positive go home and isolate, and we do some contact tracing. Those who are negative come in and have their surgery safely with decreased risk of transmission, or absolutely no risk of transmission of COVID from them to the rest of the staff, or the complications of surgery that we've read about from, again, those high number patient research articles. So that is not yet available. I will tell you that the North Dakota Department of Health is looking at antigen testing and trying to validate it. So I have a feeling there'll be more coming about that. But what we currently have is the ability to do PCR testing, again, if you have a mechanism to do that has high sensitivity, I think that's super. Between the capability of the test and the availability of supplies, I'm not seeing that as a reliable plan for your pre-op testing. So I would recommend pre-op testing be sent to the North Dakota Department of Health using the PCR test. And I think you can, according to the last testing guidance, once it is received at the state lab, it's a 48-hour turnaround. So work on your courier service to get your samples there and to decrease that time from test taken to surgery.
That's great. Thank you so much.
All right, I did try to unmute Dr. Koslin. I think she did say thank you so much, and she didn't have any follow-up. I'm gonna open it up one more time. Any questions? And of course, we've got Tim's email information, and so we can get that out to people if they'd have any follow-up questions after digesting this terrific presentation. Thanks again, Tim. I got a lot out of it. I was impressed with that Battelle system, and it was really cool to see it in process and in how it works. So thanks everyone for attending. Thank you again, Dr. Connell, and great job today. That's a lot of pressure being on those press conferences. You look terrific too.
Thank you. I do want to point out my multicultural scarf, which I thought was very timely. And then I also wanted to ask, and Molly Howell is passing this along as well, our immunization program director who does such an amazing, fantastic job. Now is really the time to reach out to your patients while we have this window of opportunity of low number of cases. And low circulating infectious disease in general, please reach out to your patients, get them caught up on all of these screenings and vaccinations and preventive services while we can. And I recognize that's a big ask because that means that we'll probably work more hours, but we really need to take care of the patient. What does the patient need and put them first and then we'll feel very satisfied at the end of the day.
All right, we did have a hand raised from Dr. Kumar. So, Dr. Kumar.
Thank you once again. For Tim, do we have any requirements for quarantine for out-of-state travel for employees or for citizens or any recommendations? Or because UND has a separate one, Sanford has a separate one.
So I'm going to be hesitant to actually tell you what I believe it is, because quite frankly, for the last several days, I have not kept up. And so let me circulate that back to you to give you the current answer. I know what it was the last time I checked, but I'm several days behind on. And so I really don't want to provide an incorrect answer, but I'll make sure that information comes back.
And I'll let you know, Dr. Kumar, that the physician advisory group is actually talking about a modification in the guidance for travel tomorrow. So I have a feeling there'll be some change to those guidances, likely with a relaxation of the quarantine for non-essential employees who are traveling domestically. I think the international quarantine is going to stay in place.
And what is the latest prediction for the time for the second surge if it comes? Or we don't have any predictions?
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Dr. Kumar, would you please repeat that because I missed it.
What is the model like predict for the timing of the second surge that we keep talking about if it ever comes? Or is there any evidence that it will come? Can you unmute me?
No, you are unmuted. Yeah.
I didn't know if that was addressed to Tim or to me.
Either.
Well, I'll go first. I'm getting my information from Dr. Stahl, who spoke with us last week, who I think told us in September he's expecting the peak of the surge. But I'm not involved in the model discussion. So I need to be very clear about that.
And I'll follow up that there hasn't been anything that has really given specific guidance to say this is what what the prediction is. And so a lot of this is coming from just historical perspective.
Thank you.
Yeah, I believe Dr. Stahl said it would be late September or October, and he did emphasize that these are just models and it's really hard to predict.
And you can just, when I described that Sophia antigen testing and the capacity, if that really worked as well as we would like it to, imagine how that would shut all of the spread down. I mean, that would be so easy to utilize in schools, universities, healthcare facilities, long-term care facility. You know, you just imagine the power of that or something like that for controlling spread.
Definitely. All right. Well, thanks again. And we'll see everybody next week. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.